brings us to the fact that it's all happening in other places other than just here. And for those of you that have been watching the industry across the ditch in Australia, they've been going through many similar, but not completely allied debates. I was interested, just when I was visiting some Australian news sites during the recent federal election, to see banners from the Australian Labor Party strongly pointing out that you got better broadband in places like Kazakhstan and Slovenia than what you could get in Australia. No doubt a similar banner campaign could probably be run here. What interested me was the assumption on both sides of the political spectrum in Australia that broadband was also a federal government issue. And we now see the parallel situation here, which, you know, we've had two of the key players speaking today, but we're very lucky to have as our next speaker Rosemary Sinclair, who is the Chief Executive of our allied Australian user group. They have the wonderful Australian tongue of ATAC, a name you'll never forget. The Australian Telecommunications Users Group. Rosemary is very experienced in this field, and she's going to share with us ATAC's perspective on broadband becoming a defining political issue in Australia, as we're definitely seeing happen in New Zealand. So welcome, Rosemary.
Thanks very much, Chris, and thank you everybody for that warm welcome, and also for the opportunity to be part of a really interesting day of discussion, because your minister and Ernie are right, we're paying very close attention to what is happening across the ditch here in New Zealand, particularly in regard to the new separation strategy and the implementation of that policy. But anyway, my task is to talk to you about why broadband became an election issue in Australia. Australia. And I thought the easiest way to do that was to go to some of the OECD statistics. And I don't know whether you have as much fun and games here as we do back home with these OECD statistics. Various people like various parts of the analysis and use it to support their position. So let me do exactly that this afternoon. The first one, which I'm not sure how clear it is from the back, but the presentation will be available to everybody, is just showing the number of broadband subscribers per 100 inhabitants, and there's a whole argument about whether you should measure it that way or by households, but anyway, per 100 inhabitants, by different types of technologies, if you can get that close, the red arrow is showing you where Australia is, and the blue star is showing you where New Zealand is, and that's as at June 2007. So that was the start of why this became an issue in the election. There's quite an argument, particularly in a place like Australia where you've got such a huge land mass and such a low population density, about whether you can do anything about it anyway. And we've got various people now talking about Australia's new DDT problem, by which they mean distance, density and terrain. Those of us that have been in Australia for some time understand that DDT is a different sort of a problem. So the label is not one that we would have chosen to run with in the debate, but nonetheless. So you see here that Australia, even when you take account of population density, is not doing as well as some other countries where population density of almost zip is equally a problem. Again, I've marked New Zealand on the chart so that you can see where you are. Then we had a look at another statistic, which is the penetration rate by the gross domestic product per capita. For me, this is a question of can we afford to do a bit better than we are, given the sorts of problems that we face. And again, position is, well, yes, we can afford to do better than we are. If you look at our penetration by our ability to deal with the problem, then we're lower down the ranks than we ought to be. This is the one that our minister used to use in the face of 20 other metrics on where we sit, none of which look very flash. Our previous minister used always to use the increase rate, having put some subsidy schemes in place, and by hook or by crook, by fair means or foul, got the industry to move a bit, then the statistics minister Kernan used to always use was how much faster broadband uptake is going, and used to always to say Australia ranks fourth in the world, leaving out that its growth rate of a low base that was being measured. And again, I've put the blue star over New Zealand. So availability was issue number one. The second issue is the broadband price ranges. And if you look at Australia, the entry price is not too bad, but the upper range, if you want to use anything over 200 megabytes a month or 400 megabytes a month, in other words, if you want to do serious broadband, then you're at the upper end of this price line, and you can see that you're not in strong company up that upper end. So the price ranges were again a problem, and the previous couple of speakers before me this afternoon have alluded to the same sort of problem that you've got in New Zealand. And even worse then, if you look at prices per megabyte, it should be megabyte, not megabit, October 2007, Australians and indeed New Zealanders, and I'm sorry I haven't marked New Zealand, and I can't read it from here, but you can find it when you have a look. We're pretty much in the same order of magnitude of paying an awful lot for the bandwidth that we're consuming. Not an easy problem to fix. I'm not expecting a quick fix here, sort of underpinning issue that lead governments, ours and now yours, to want a bit more than motherhood statements about what we're all going to do. You've really covered off in a more general sense during the day why it all matters. We're really at a tipping point in terms of the way we organise business, government services, and social activities. And it's all based on the way we organise innovation and create value. And these were just a couple of quotes from a very interesting conference at the beginning of last year. This notion of the open networked organization, the Enterprise 2.0. So social networking tools that we see, you know, rife amongst the kids at the moment, if you like, are slowly, slowly creeping not only into the ageing population, dare I say, for social reasons, but also now starting to be explored quite seriously as enterprise communication tools and government services communication tools. And it's the collaboration that's really the foundation of this new paradigm of organising. And the fundamental infrastructure to make all this happen, of course, is the network. Anyway, back to Australia, and I'm talking now about the previous government. They came at the problem of fixing those numbers, to put it at its most simple, in a variety of ways, with a range of funding programs, and I'm not going to bore you with the details, but we had the Connect Australia programs, and then we had the Australian Broadband Guarantee. And I remember the minister announcing it at my conference, and she said, all Australians, wherever they live, are guaranteed access to metro-comparable broadband. I said, Minister, that's a big call. You know, did you actually mean that? You know, you wouldn't kind of like to retract. No, no, that's the deal. So the Australian Broadband Guarantee was put in place, and a bit of a slip, I'd have to say, between the policy and the practice, but nonetheless, quite a bit of money and quite a strong commitment. And you need a strong commitment in Australia when you make a statement like that, because just a quick picture of the size of the place and where people live and work. We're from one end of the country to the other. So the mix of technologies is a really important part of our strategy to deliver broadband to all Australians. And the reality of our place is that we're going to need a mix of technology. However excited I get about fibre to the node, when I go back to the map, I'm wondering how many of those premises are not going to be able to be reached by node-based technology. So we have to think about wireless, we have to think about satellite as well. So then along comes the Shadow Minister on the 21st of March and announces Labor's policy, new direction for communications, a broadband future for Australia. We're going to build a national broadband network. And we're going to do it so that it covers 98% of Australians with high-speed broadband. The tagline is over 40 times faster, the faster being 256 kilobits per second. So we've got a minimum guaranteed speed here of 12 megabits per second. With the rollout of a new fibre to the node network, and the remaining 2% are going to be covered, are going to have improved broadband services. Read into that what you will. The proposal is that we're going to partner with the private sector, deliver the network over 5 years. We're going to ensure competition with an open access network. This is why we become very interested in developments in New Zealand, where we've got open access networks providing equivalents of access charges and scope for access seekers to differentiate their offerings, regulatory reforms, unstated, undescribed, really unexplored, to ensure certainty for the investment. And then the big carrot, $4.7 billion of Australian government money. So we're then seriously starting to look at fibre to the node. And all of a sudden a whole range of other issues come into the mix, many of which we've discussed here today. You know, how long are the copper links that you've got? Can you actually do fiber to the node. Where does IP fit into driving the demand for the service? It's all very well to roll out a network, but you actually need people who want to pay for the services to make the whole thing viable. How do the planning controls fit in? Do you have to go underground? Can you go overhead? Competition from cable companies is not, frankly, a huge issue in Australia for history that we can talk about another day. And a whole debate started about whether the regulatory environment stifles or encourages investment. So then we started looking at global developments. Other people getting very busy all around the world. I won't go into any of the detail, but suddenly we realise we're really part of a global debate and a global shift, again, which has been discussed well here today. And then we run into this little problem. And I've just gone to these couple of slides because they explain what the little problem is and why certain incumbent telcos are taking a very strong position in this debate and pushing for particular solutions. And the reason is they've got this big problem that their voice revenues are disappearing. And despite all the hoo-ha about data revenues and mobile data revenues and broadband revenues, at the moment 80% of revenues for telcos all around the world are related to voice-based activities. It will change over time, no doubt about it. But if I'm looking at these debates with my eye on my current cash flow, then voice is very important. Long-term revenue trends are that things will move, but voice is going mobile and IP, both of which are much more competitive environments than fixed network-based voice services. So albeit revenues in absolute terms might be going up, margins are going in the wrong direction because of voice services delivered over those new platforms. So that's a core position that you really have to understand in terms of the position of incumbent telcos in this debate about how we're going to get fiber networks. works out and about and what they should look like. Just for a minute, because this was another kind of underlying debate that was going on at the same time, the regulation around telco policy is contained in a specific set of provisions in the Trade Practices Act. The Trade Practices Act covers a whole heap of other things, but there's some telco-specific stuff in there. The policy objective, the core reason for doing anything at all about telco stuff is the long-term interests of end users. And that's achieved by promoting competition, end-to-end connectivity, and efficient investment. In regard to the investment and the price setting, when you get to regulated prices, the regulator has to take account of the risks involved in making the investment. And that's all very well and good, that all seems straightforward. But the real issue is the price. And while we've got the political activity in March and early last year going on, we've also got a quiet little discussion going on about a proposal to build a fibre to the node network with a stumbling block around the price. And the price, it depends on where you start. And if you're starting as an incumbent telco with very significant revenues which have very high margins, then your calculation of the price you need to charge access seekers and retail consumers for fibre to the node services looks very different than if you're a new entrant building a fibre network, quite happy to have all comers running over that access network, not carrying any legacy margins, not carrying big overheads for one reason or another. So the prices that were part of that discussion, and I'm talking March, April last year, were these. Telstra was reported, because these were not public domain discussions, these were discussions between players behind closed doors, including the federal government. But reportedly the figure at that time was $85 to $95 per month wholesale access price. So the retail price has got a significant margin on top of that. And you'll recall earlier that I showed you what the existing prices were in Australia for broadband access. This kind of wholesale price would really have worsened that situation quite considerably. So for ATAG, availability of broadband is one thing. Affordability of broadband is an entirely different matter. Because we can have the networks out there, but if people can't afford to take the service up, then we're not going to get the sort of economic transformations that people keep talking about. So there was a competitive bid lodged through a tricky undertakings process, and that group said, we'll do it for $45 a month. And then there was a whole new wave of solutions by fibre-only wholesale, born wholesale operators, which said, well, our price we think is about $30 a month. So the federal government said, no, we're not going to proceed with this closed-door deal at $85 a month. That's not on the agenda. We're going to have a task force looking into all this. So they put in place a task force looking at high-speed broadband network infrastructure in capital cities and major regional centres, which means we've still got our little problem about what we all do with people in the bush. But we park that for a moment. And they were going to look at the network and operational characteristics, the pricing principles, the regulatory measures, arrangements for compensation for people who'd invested in DSLAMs who were suddenly going to be passed by the speed of light, so to speak, and how on earth we would provide an open and transparent process, at which point we were all looking at you guys, I can tell you, to say, well, we'll just do what they're doing. If we like the look of what they've done, we'll do that, and that'll sort that bit of it out. So, our position, of course, was that we didn't really like, you know, these behind-closed-door deals, and that the public policy making was a better option. And so we were busily working away on making submissions to the task force and being part of the debate. And then the election was called, 24th of November. Was the date that was set. During the year, broadband, because we had the government's position on broadband, and then we had the Labor Party proposal on the 27th of March During the year, this is the kind of press coverage that the broadband issue got just from the Liberal government. So, let me go back. So, it just was relentless. Relentless. So, every time someone mentions Kazakhstan, someone else mentions Swaziland. And on it went. So it seems to me that the nature of the debate here is sort of warming up to this kind of intensity, I would think. So it was a very busy time. And a lot of the debate, I have to say, was based on, you know, here's the press release, I've got to get it into the 6 o'clock news at night. And there wasn't there wasn't a great deal of serious analysis. It wasn't an environment for serious analysis. In terms of the issues for the election, these were really the key ones, and you'll see that broadband's up there. We had a substantial change to our industrial relations system called Work Choices. And it was a big election issue. We had had 6 interest rate rises since the previous federal election, and that was a big issue. Health and Medicare are just huge issues in Australia, and we have a distinction between the federal government who funds it and the state governments who deliver the services. So there's always endless tussles about who's not doing what properly. Same with education. Overall, people were starting to be concerned about the economy. The environment's a big issue. National security remains a big issue. But Labor's pledge to, as this media group captures it, Labor's pledge to spearhead construction of a $4.7 billion fibre-to-the-node broadband network was an election issue. And then we had some inflation figures released just on the 24th of October, which showed things were heading in the wrong direction. So there's no doubt, with all the work that went on and all the press coverage that went on, broadband became a big issue. And for every one of those press releases that Minister Keenan put out that I showed you, there was, you know, equal and then some from the Labor Party. So it was a huge and busy time. Anyway, so we have the election. Labor government's been elected now. That was a very significant change for us because we'd had a Liberal government for 11 and a bit years since 1996. New kids on the block, a number of whom have spent all their time in Parliament in opposition. So we've really got a very new government in place. But the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, has worked as a staffer to a number of federal and state governments, premiers and the like. And he is really determined and committed that all election promises are basically on a score sheet and they're going to be ticked off. So now we're at quite an interesting stage where we have a commitment to a $4.7 billion national broadband network. 98% of Australian households and businesses within 5 years. And he is absolutely determined that the commitment to start rolling this network out by the end of this calendar year will be achieved. So we're now in an interesting situation where there's a carrot, if you like, of $4.7 billion, but a very, very stringent timetable. And so the negotiation, I think, is going to be quite an interesting process. And what we've got in train now is that we've now got another panel of experts, some of whom were the previous experts and some of whom are new experts. And they are to assess proposals that come forward under request for proposal process, which is out there now, that went out there on the 11th of March. We all got to comment on it by the 17th of March. I should add that the Opel contract, which was an almost $1 billion contract with Optus, to provide wireless broadband in regional and remote Australia, was terminated on the 2nd of April. So that is taken now out of the play. That was very important because it would have provided competitive place would have changed the cost structure for locally based ISPs in terms of providing broadband services. So then the minister calls for the proposals, requests for proposals. They have to be lodged by the 25th of July. There's a bid requirement bond, of $5 million, which has got to be lodged by the 23rd of May. And once you do that, you become a proponent, and then there's a bit of a gag on people talking about their bids. Mainly it's about people talking about other people's bids. Because when we went through the Opal process, we had quite sustained political activity calling into question the viability of bids from other players. So that's all been shut down this time. Two other pieces of work is a request for submissions on regulatory issues. It's a blank sheet of paper. You get to put in whatever you think are regulatory issues that need to be addressed in supporting the development of this network. One of the key issues for us will be that we want the long-term interests of end users to stay as the core policy objective, rather than a shorter term objective of encouraging investment. And there's quite a debate going on in Australia that the government should change its policy focus from worrying about the long-term interests of end users to encouraging investment in fibre networks first, last and always. And then there's a call for submissions on broadband solutions for remote areas. Again, a blank sheet of paper. If anyone's got a good idea, then they can put that forward. So pretty tight time frames. The regulatory issues papers have to be lodged by the 25th of June, so then they can be taken into account by the expert panel when it's contemplating the proposals which are to come forward by the 25th of July. And there are iterative processes where people can be interviewed and ask questions and make submissions and so on and so forth. So, quite a complicated process, but at the moment the minister's sticking absolutely with the milestones that are outlined in this slide for you. Assessing things August, September, identifying the preferred proponent in September. It's possible for someone to pop up and say, look, I'd like to do Western Australia, or I want to do Tasmania or South Australia, as well as someone popping up to say, I want to do the whole lot. Negotiations are going to begin and conclude between September and October. The decision will be out by October, and hell's bells, there'll be the photo opportunity in December. Someone will be turning a sod somewhere in Australia, and there'll be 50,000 television crews and photographers there to take a photo of the moment that Australia starts its fibre to the node network build out. At the same time that all that's going on, in quieter places, people are really discussing the ins and outs of fibre investment and the policy challenges around all that. And that's a reference to some work going on at the OECD, which is actually very interesting work. I'd like to change the flavour of the discussion now to just very briefly finish off by talking about a campaign that we've got going in Australia that we're calling the Rome Fair Campaign. And essentially what I did before I came was I just went to public websites. So I'm absolutely happy to be torn down into shreds and flames by people saying, no, no, those are not our current prices. So that's okay. Okay, but if I'm just an ordinary little consumer and I want to figure out how much it's going to cost me for the privilege of taking my mobile phone, you know, that anywhere, anytime, anyone, and I always say yes, but not at any price, kind of connectivity that we've all enjoying or enduring, I'm not sure. So if I'm a Vodafone Australia customer and I'm roaming around in New Zealand, then to call a New Zealand number using my Vodafone service from Australia is going to cost me $1.49 per minute. If I want to think about calling home to see how the kids are, or you know, those kind of activities, those social networking activities that we talked about before, that need for communication that was spoken about earlier, then that call costs me $3.02 a minute to call home. If I want to receive a call from the kid saying, gosh, I forgot my lunch, what will I do? You know, like they do when they're 8. That to receive the call, $1.17 a minute. And if I want to call anywhere other than Australia, $3.75 a minute, and SMS is at 75 cents. So obviously whilst I'm here, SMS is the way I go. If I'm a Vodafone New Zealand customer, and I want to take my Vodafone New Zealand phone to Australia, then to call New Zealand, okay, so this is the same network call just going in the other way, that's a standard home rate of 79 cents per minute. If I want to call the UK, then it's the 79 cents plus $2 a minute. If I want to call the US or anywhere in Asia Pacific, it's that rate plus $3 a minute. And if I want to call the rest of the world, it's that rate plus $5 a minute. In Australia, we've got a third and indeed fourth mobile operator, and we've got Hutchison. And I've got to say, Hutchison is the innovator in the Australian market. They're the fourth mobile operator, and they have, I think, maybe 12% of the market. It's the smallest, you know, by quite a long way. But they are the folks that innovate. They are the folks that introduce the cap plans for voice. They're the folks that introduce the cap plans for broadband services. They are the folks that introduce this roam-like home service, but it's quite limited. You've got to be on their network, and if you are in Italy, Sweden, Israel, UK, couple of other places, not here in New Zealand, of course, because they're not here, they will let you call back to Australia for 35 cents per 30 seconds, plus the 25 cent flag fee. There's a range of limitations which mean that this is quite a limited service. But the interesting thing is that you can tell from that it doesn't cost anybody anywhere near $5 a minute to make a mobile phone call backwards and forwards across country borders. So in the EU, they had the same sort of problem between, for heaven's sake, the European Union states, where these international roaming rates were as bad as they are currently between Australia and New Zealand. And I should quickly add that whilst I've used Vodafone as an example, they're just an example. Everybody else in this game is charging the same sorts of rates. So I don't intend to single Vodafone out, but it's just the case study I use. Anyway, after much huffing and puffing in Europe over a period of 8 years, right, so this did not happen in a minute, the regulators said, look, we've waited for the market to move and we've had all these consultations and nothing's happening. So we're going to mandate, okay, in a competitive market like mobiles, we're going to mandate the roaming rate. So they started, any country in the European Union, 49 cents a minute for making calls, 24 cents a minute for receiving calls, and it's on a glide path over the next couple of years. And our campaign, the Roam Fair campaign, I would like to suggest to Tuans that it's something that we work on together. And we actually use the closer economic relationship between Australia and New Zealand to say to people, why can't we fix this? Between Australia and New Zealand, it takes me less time to get to New Zealand than it takes me to get to Perth. Okay? But when I'm in Australia, I'm ringing around all the place without any dramas. So my question is, if the CER between Australia and New Zealand can't fix it, then, you know, really, what on earth can fix it? And we would really love Tuans to work with us on it. And that's the end of the story. That's our bring roaming rates down. You'll note that I've been very careful not to say roam free because it's unreasonable, right? It's unsustainable. Everybody expects people to make a fair return on whatever service they're offering so that they can innovate and build new networks and all the rest of it. But those prices are just way over the odds. And when your regulator does your mobile termination rate review, then you'll get some idea of how over the top they are. In Australia, the regulator did that review a couple of years ago, and albeit that they allowed a very slow glide path, we're now down to 9 cents a minute for mobile termination. Everybody knows that the cost is way, way less than that. So to be charged something over $5 a minute for something that's costing in the cents per minute is really extortion. Anyway, I'll leave that with you. Thank you very much for your time. If you've got time for a couple of questions to raise, please, anyone want to kick off? Any questions? Okay, Rosemary will be around after the drink, so I think we'd appreciate some feedback as to getting involved in this issue from a member point of view, but just to show that we have other fights. And mobile termination has definitely been one for the last few years.